welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour. This week we are going to the Oscars. Well, of course we're going to the Oscars because we've been covering all of the Oscar films, and it seems to me that I have a good panel of people to talk about this. Ian Fales is here. How are you, Ian?
Good, Mike. How are you doing?
And Matt Graham is here. How are you?
I'm also good. Glad to be here.
So we're going to be discussing the films that are up for Oscars this year. Of course, it's been established now that you can't get an Oscar nomination unless you do about 900 to 1,200 effects and have a mega-budget film where almost every sequence involves a visual effect. There's no way you could get a nomination anymore if you just did a that's not true. This week we're going to be discussing Hereafter because it's the film that is the exception. It's the film that has managed to get an Oscar nomination with only about 9 minutes of visual effects work. Now, it's a very critical 9 minutes of visual effects work. In fact, it sets up the entire film, and without it, the film would not work. That being said, it's very unusual compared to the other films that are in the lineup. Ian, do you want to just give us the five films?
Yeah, sure. The five films are Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, Part 1, Iron Man 2, Alice in Wonderland, Inception, and, of course, Hereafter.
Now, we'll come back and get your opinions on those ones. But obviously, in all the other cases, those films have pretty much wall-to-wall visual effects, certainly in things like Alice in Wonderland, you know, with the exception of the sequence before they go down, and even there, because of the dimensionalization, you could argue, there's the entire world is visual effects. It wouldn't exist without it. I guess the closest to Hereafter, Matt, would probably be Inception.
Yeah, I mean, look, some of the films had a huge amount of practical effects, and Inception definitely led the way there with some amazing practical effects. Still had a hefty VFX count, but obviously not as much as Alice in Wonderland, which was through the roof.
Yeah, and I think that Iron Man and obviously Harry Potter and stuff, there are huge sequences in those that are live action, but nevertheless, we would think of them as effects films. I don't think most people would think of Hereafter as an effects film. If you were describing it to a possible hot date, Ian, you probably wouldn't describe it that way, would you?
You wouldn't. I mean, although that the opening tsunami sequence is obviously full of digital effects, that's about it. You know, there's a few afterlife shots sprinkled throughout the film. But yeah, no, it's only that opening 5-minute sequence.
I think that there actually are a couple of other shots which we'll come to later with the bomb blast in the tube and stuff. But
true.
But yes, you're right. It's pretty much that opening sequence. So I guess the show this week we'll have a look at, of course, Hereafter and that incredible 9-minute sequence of Fluid Sims. And then we'll have a bit of a whip around us what everyone's opinion on the other shows are. And in fact, we've actually covered here on the VFX show each of the other Oscar-nominated films. And so we'll, at the end of the show, give you references if you want to go back and listen to those, though not with you two excellent gentlemen, but with other members of the panel. So, Matt, let's start with the film Hereafter. And did you like it as a film?
As a film, not so much. I think I would have been quite happy to walk out after 20 minutes and I'd gone, oh, that was a really good VFX scene. I got to the end and I was like, really? I'm not believing or relating to these characters anymore. It just became a bit too far-fetched. And look, the opening sequence was very cool. Scanline did a great job with the tsunami scene.
I'm going to cut you off on discussing the effects just yet because I just want to sit on the film and get Ian's opinion before we start going into individual shots, yep, just as we do each week. Though, of course, we like to discuss the visual effects in depth. Ian, are you a Clint Eastwood fan?
I am, and I really enjoyed this film, sorry to say, Matt. I think one of the reasons I enjoyed it was that it was just so expertly paced. There was such a... you really had to invest in it a little bit because obviously there's different characters on different sides of the world and kind of three or four stories going on at once. And you really had to wait until all of those kind of merged together until you knew what the film was. And I think that was my favourite bit about it.
You didn't feel in like near the end it just got a bit silly?
which bit was silly?
Well, you know everyone's going to come together at some stage, but then they all come together at the book fair. It's like, yay, happy ending in the book fair. And then, you know, the kid somehow knows, he's had got time after standing out the front of Matt Damon's hotel all day and all night to phone another hotel and find out where she is.
Well, maybe it did come together in a typical movie way, but each of the characters, if you think about it, sort of had their own progression. You know, she was such an intellectual that she wanted to go and write this book and explore that. And the psychic Mac Damon, he had his own demons. You know, he had to deal with them. And, of course, the little boy had to as well. So I almost felt like they each had their own story. And it just happened to be, of course, that they met at the book fair. But no, for me, that wasn't an issue at all.
Cool.
There's a concept in script writing actually called, I think I'm going to pronounce this wrong, but it's like Dust Ex Machina, which is basically the idea of an inextricable problem basically suddenly being abruptly solved in a contrived or kind of unexpected way. And I think that's what Matt's referring to, that the book fair was a device, obviously, to bring the stories together. The only thing I would say is you needed some device to bring the stories together, otherwise you wouldn't have had a film. Was the book fair an implausible way to do that? I don't really think so. I think that inside the world of filmmaking, and probably inside every one of the five films we're going to discuss, it was probably the least stretch of implausibility that I could probably point to. But then I say that because I just love Clint Eastwood, and I liked the slow-paced. I like the acting that happens between dialogue lines. I like the fact that you would have actual acting from Matt Damon when all he was doing was eating his dinner. No one gave him any lines. No one would sort of rush it. He wouldn't rush the delivery. No one was sort of fighting to get attention as an actor. I just felt like this had that sort of Clint Eastwood quiet calm about it that I find so appealing in his latter work. I've got to say, I'll throw in one quote for VFX. I'm breaking my own rule that I just told Matt not to. But the visual effects supervisor on this was Michael Owens, and apparently Michael Owens would occasionally speak to Clint Eastwood and sort of say, like, really big problem, I don't know if we can work this out. To which Clint would just come back with a quiet reply, you'll work it out. It's just like... And in an article I read, Owens actually went on to say that, that of course, they keep on pulling rabbits out of hats, so everyone kind of thinks it's normal, but he feels like yelling out sometimes, we nearly killed the goddamn rabbit, we can't keep doing this. But anyway...
Look, the pace was really good of the film. I just felt like the pace didn't get us anywhere by the end.
I mean, sure, let's agree to disagree because sure. We should get on to the VFX work. But, I mean, I do think that it wouldn't be a film for everybody. I saw this, I've got to admit, at the Open Air Cinema at in Australia, in Sydney. In summer, they have an outdoor film festival thing that happens opposite the Opera House. So literally, they put the screen in the water and you go and have a lovely meal and then sit outside and watch this projected. So I could have seen, you know, a rerun of the original, think of a really bad film, Beverly Hillbillies movie, and I probably would have enjoyed the evening. So I was kind of biased going in. But anyway, so let's go to the visual effects work and discuss in a bit more detail. It wasn't that long ago, Matt, that we just thought any kind of fluids was remarkable. And I'm going to say around the time of the Poseidon remake, for example, just, you know, large waves were incredibly complex. And what, 2 years ago they gave out the sci-fi Oscar for Fluid Sims? I mean, this is still relatively young visual effects work.
I think the Fluid Sims were great, but also the rigid body sims of built cars and buildings from trees falling down. It all just works so well. And even the digital doubles floating through the water.
I think you're right, Matt. There's so much good fluid sim going on, but then if you watch the breakdowns, as you mentioned before, there's so much else in there.
Mm,
you
know? And they're really helping to sell it in. I mean, I love the approach that they went to film this by just going out into the ocean and filming the actress in the waves of the ocean. Then everything else was CG. I thought it was great. Yeah,
and then putting her into those confined streetscapes as well was sort of brilliant. And, you know, I was just rewatching those breakdowns and noticing that so many of the close-up shots were fully CG, or at least augmented, you know, in that way. And I actually was going to say that I thought those worked better than the wide shots.
Definitely.
Which, you know, have a lot of epicness and scale and, you know,
the only exception I'd say to that is the initial shot looking down when it's the shot that's sort of the very close to the reality of this was filmed by a handycam, and the wave hits the beach and everyone's running off the beach and it's sort of looking to the left of the ocean from high up, and that wide shot I thought stood up really, really well. I think some of the wide shots in the streets maybe not so much, but we're talking fractions of degrees here, but that shot, that in particular shot, I thought that was just like a, you know, take that one to the bank shot. You didn't like that? Or
no, I think I know which one you're talking about, and I like that one. The only shot that I didn't think actually worked really, really well was sort of when the wave was really hitting up against the hotel and it was sort of hitting all the umbrellas. I just didn't think it quite worked. But basically everything else in there I was convinced of and didn't realise how much, you know, it was a built environment. including the shot where she's, and I don't want to give it away, but she sort of gets...
Well, no, we totally, it's not, we're not holding back.
She gets resuscitated and there's this burning boat in the background. And, you know, there's, they're basically mo-capped performers trying to put the fire out, you know, with simulated smoke. And, you know, I don't think I picked that.
Well, I found fascinating about that shot is that her distressed, bruised face makeup was digitally added.
Yeah, that was very cool. The UV projection maps onto her with... Yeah, I was surprised that they actually went to the extent of doing that. But, you know, if you're only doing 169 shots, let's add another one just to make it a bit better.
And the thing about that, which is really interesting, is that that really is Clint Eastwood and Michael Owens. Because in his previous film, the football one, Invictus, that's the approach he took to adding a bit of dirt and bruising.
Love that film.
Yeah. You know, to the rugby players. And so here he is again saying, well, I'm not going to bother doing makeup on set if I don't need to. I'll just add it. And he has the confidence in Michael Owens and Scanline to do it.
Yeah, let's discuss how they did those body sequences. Matt, you mentioned them, like the body doubles. So they shot all that as... motion capture, and the way they did it was they actually got the actresses on wire rigs, and the wire rig actually had a circular piece around the stomach region. So I've seen these rigs before, and in fact, Matt, you and I have shot with them before, where it allows the actor to not only do a degree of freedom where you would be pivoted at the waist left and right, but in fact you can rotate round. This really helps avoid the problem you often get with wire work when people are falling and spinning, which is that their hands come together as they miss the wires and their feet come together as they miss the wires as they tumble, and then they go back out again. And so by having the actors on wires on these advanced wire rigs, they could tug them and pull them and stuff, and then you'd still get the actor performing, you know, fighting the water. It wouldn't be like a dummy as in a ragdoll simulation that you might do otherwise. But they could take that motion capture data and then apply that to her, for example, when she's being tugged down underneath. So I think they get a really good mix there between what you would have got from a full simulated ragdoll type thing and what you'd get from trying to somehow film the actor on green screen and then sort of place them in, where you're invariably not going to be able to have the camera right and you'd have some real problems of them feeling to drift in the water. Because I think it's an interesting thing about water is that people imagine that things aren't nailed down, so consequently drift isn't a problem. But in fact, you really read a what I'm going to call flow drift. In other words, you really read a drift where the character seems to be moving left and right and they should just be moving down with the current. I don't think it's as forgiving as people believe. I actually think it can be like killer hard to track water. And of course, you haven't got much to lock onto because invariably, so in the sequence that I think you were talking about, Matt, where she was out in the ocean, that's one hell of a tracking problem because...
Yeah, I just looked at that and just thought that would have been absolute nightmare to re-piece all that back together. But it was seamless. As you said, in the close-up shots were a lot better than the wide shots as you're going through that laneway being doused with water left, right and center. What did you think, though, about the speaking of floating bodies underneath the water, did you guys buy her body, digital body, floating underneath the water?
Yeah, I thought that was all right. I mean, that shot also in the context is a bit more ethereal.
Yeah.
You know, she's kind of entering the halfway point, perhaps, and...
Because I think it's a bit trickier to get the skin right where from that kind of position. I mean, the light's already being diffused going down and it's giving this new kind of light that we're not as familiar with. We don't spend our lives underneath the water, so it's an unfamiliar kind of scene as it is. But I think the animation of her body floating through was really good.
Yeah, so Giant Studios did that motion capture and then that fed into the stuff, obviously, that... Chad and others at Scanlines did for putting it together. I think there's a really interesting thing here about Scanlines' work because obviously it's really easy to lock in on the flow line fluid sim stuff, which of course produces accurate fluid simulations. But we shouldn't sort of miss the fact that there's actually two aspects to the shot selling. There's the accuracy of the fluid sim, but then actually there's the realism of the lighting and the rendering of them, because just because you've got a good fluid sim doesn't mean that you're going to render it and composite it and combine it well. And I think I'm feeling a bit sorry for the compositors at Scanline, because I think that it's really easy to lock onto how great the fluid sim is and how realistically it moves. And the, as you said, Matt, the really great rigid body sims of the buildings being crashed apart when the fluids go through them. And yet I really thought that they got the lighting right, they had the integration right, the keying and stuff was really working well. And a lot of those shots where he's looking out and they're sort of looking at the tsunami about to come in were, of course, all massive, what we'd normally call sky replacements, but obviously sky and water replacements. Where was it shot? I think that was shot in Hawaii.
Yeah.
I mean, look, they had a lot of reference material to draw on. Obviously, these days, everyone's got a handy cam version of every major catastrophe happening. So I think they had a lot of reference work, which helped them get along.
Yeah, I mean, to pull this off, Michael Owens actually pulled in a couple of other friends, because most people would know Michael Owens is ex-ILM, and he pulled in Scott Squires, who's a great guy, one of the original supervisors on Star Wars Episode 1, really good ILM ex-alumni, to help out, I think, in the early... And also, because they did sort of storyboarding of this in a way that is typically not something that Clint Eastwood does. And I think also the DP, it was Tom Stern, I think it was the DP, did a really good job, because these were, you know, very much digitally created, if you like, fully animated sequences. And so, you know, I think to fit that in, to make it feel right and to not have that overpower the story, but by the same token serve the story, because it really was serving the story. And so I think as a sequence, I find it really hard to fault.
And you know what I also find interesting, that Clint Eastwood's generally known for his, you know, beautiful films and sort of expert pacing, but interestingly, his last couple of films have relied on visual effects a lot to help tell his story. If we think about Invictus and Flags of Our Fathers and Changeling...
Space Cowboys?
Space Cowboys. Yeah, I mean, I feel like he's really embraced visual effects to help tell the story. It's never over the top, but it's always something that helps it along.
I think these days people have to embrace visual effects. I'm surprised that the shot count was so low. These days, as soon as you start rolling a frame, you've got 300 VFX shots of just wire removal, replacing palm trees and things like that. So to get through this entire film and only have, what was it, 169 shots, I think it's really good.
And let's talk about some of those other shots, because the afterlife ones I thought were quite interesting.
It was a nice feel.
A nice feel. And, you know, apparently... they were kind of based, I think, on some of the shots in Close Encounters. And obviously Steven Spielberg was a producer on this film. And I think when I was talking to the Scanline guys, they were saying, oh, we showed Steven a shot of, you know, some concept work. And he said, oh, that's from Close Encounters, isn't it? And they said, oh, yeah, sorry. But, you know, he liked it. And it's sort of that look stayed in those afterlife shots.
Yeah, there seemed to be quite a lot of camera mapping techniques going on virtualizing the cameras, and I think that there was some really obviously heavy duty image processing. So in a film where everything was really photoreal, you had a like completely out there kind of image processing designery feel, and a pretty open brief from what I can understand on how to do stuff. I'm gonna have a slight dig at Scanline now, because we normally obviously at FX Guide do stories on the films, and you'll note that we do have a story on this film, but we don't have the in-depth story we wanted to have, because Scanline decided at the last minute they didn't want to do an in-depth story with us, because I don't know why really, but we leave the standing invitation to always have an in-depth discussion with Scanline whenever they want to, so I don't know exactly in terms of,
because they've done some awesome work. I'd love to know more.
I would love to sit down with them one-on-one myself and go through stuff, but you know, clearly in a film where you've got someone like Clint Eastwood, who is a reputation for providing quite a lot of space creatively and in terms of implementation, he's not like nitpicking, then there was a lot of ways they could have gone with that sequence. I think it's a difficult thing because, you know, you don't want to be too specific, and you have, I think, in the popular culture, this idea of, you know, stay away from the light. So you sort of, there are a few things you have to do, and yet you know, the film cut away from those pretty quickly. Like once the character that Matt Damon's playing is communicating with somebody from the... We don't actually have any more sequences. You'll have it at the establishment point, like a kind of a snap. And then after that, they sort of stayed away from going back to it, which I think is healthy for the film. But you needed a strong visual that would sort of carry you through. I think if most people were asked, they'd imagine there was a lot more of those shots of the afterlife, the white sort of light shots, than there actually were in the film. Because I was noting that they rarely cut back to it once he started. You know, after he did the, like, hold your hands, I'll get the contact
What did you think about the very last one where he's not actually holding anyone's hands and it's just kind of that flash to dream sequence? That kind of felt out of place for me. It's like using
well,
a similar technique.
Well, let me ask you this. How did you interpret it as an audience member?
I interpret it as maybe a flash forward, but I forgave it because we don't know the full extent of his magical powers.
Well, okay, so
he could be able to see the future if he's a psychic. I mean, I don't know the rules of psychics. Can you just talk to dead people, or are you allowed to, you know, flash forward into time as well?
I guess for me, what I found really interesting about it was that it finished the plot out without giving me all the answers, which, of course, in a film about the curiosity of the afterlife made sense. And also it had to obviously not look like he was being spoken to from the afterlife. Otherwise, it'd be very confusing as to who it was. Had somebody died? Is he seeing her death, looking back?
But did we need a flash forward? I mean, we knew he was
I found it really stylistically interesting to have that moment of... Because it's the first time he reaches out to a person. It's the first time he smiles. and he touches her and connects with her without any consequence.
Yep.
So something had to change. So stylistically, I liked that wasn't answered. It was answered in terms of it was enough information that they were going to get together, but not answered in terms of, I'm going to now explain what just happened. Hey, what just happened? Well, let me just explain. I think what you might have experienced there is exposition, exposition, exposition.
Yeah,
just kiss, drop the end title and go for it.
Yeah, the exposition of the film I enjoyed a lot more than some of the other ones we'll talk about in a bit.
And I've got to say, just in terms of Clint Eastwood using visual effects, I really was sort of half joking, obviously, but also quite critical of Space Cowboys. So that's like year 2000, so a decade ago. And I just didn't think the visual effects were used particularly well in that. There were other things like In the Line of Fire that had some stuff in it. But yeah, you have to go really, I think, past the sort of Million Dollar Baby stuff up until Flags of Our Father before you see films where Clint's film has visual effects that would certainly cause this show to raise an eyebrow and be impressed. Because Flags of Our Father had massive visual effects work without green screen and just hardcore roto and exceptionally fine quality. And from there on out, you can really not fault it for the work that he's done. I mean, obviously, Gran Torino wasn't a big effects film, but Invictus, the crowd sims were really good and all the crowd replications were really good. And it felt like a really big event at the end of the World Cup and stuff. I mean, it worked really, really well. I think the effects in this are really, really good. I just don't think Clint Eastwood is a natural at directing effects. And quite frankly, I think that Michael Owens is.
Well, I always forget how big a director Clint Eastwood is. I always think of him first and foremost as an actor, but he's done over 30 films.
Is that because we have a Dirty Harry pinball machine up the end of the office?
Well, yeah, how can you possibly forget? Yeah. But no, I think it's him coming of age and he's moved with the times. He's been directing films since 1971. So when you've been doing it for 40 years, you're going to go along with whatever new tools. I'm sure he's not picking up the same camera he was using back then. He's developed a tight team that he trusts and he's happy to try new effects. And
that is Michael Owens. I mean, I think you're right, Mike. I think it's a confidence in him. You know, if the director's not going to have the confidence, and I'm not saying he doesn't, but Michael Owens knows what he's doing, doesn't he?
Yeah.
So,
I can't give you the reference because I read it ages ago, but it was somebody that worked on one of his films. And the thing that they were commenting on, which I thought was kind of nice, is he said that most of the people on a Clint Eastwood set are the same people that were on the last Clint Eastwood set. So he's terribly loyal to people. And he's terribly unassuming. Like, he'll just stand in the lunch queue like anybody else, and it's all very quiet. And it's not like action and cut. It's like, that'll do. And they just kind of move on. And there's obviously huge respect for the actors. But there's not a huge respect to the actors at the cost of the other crew. It's like they just quietly get on and make their films. And I understand from, and I wish I had the source on this, I'm sorry, like, honestly read it about 3 years ago. It was like, they come in on budget, on time, and everybody just quietly, successfully gets on with it. In a culture, a Hollywood, that is not the common occurrence. So, it's really reassuring to see a director this accomplished come up. Now, I guess the only other thing is to cover a couple of those other points we mentioned earlier. So there's the bombing of the tube station, which obviously was iconic. Did anyone... Were you guys aware of that enough that you saw it coming in terms of the film? Like, my wife, for example, wasn't. She knew the event, but she wasn't sort of aware enough that the tube station thing, I'm thinking if you're English, you'd have been, oh my God, this is going to be the bombing. Did you guys catch
it? No, I didn't see it coming.
I remember it happened, but I did see it coming because I was dumb enough to watch the VFX breakdowns before.
Before you saw it, okay.
So I kind of saw that part of it coming. One thing I was hoping would be different on the big screen was the sparks. The explosion in the tube tunnel, also the little spark at the beginning when we're going through the rapid water. Every time there's a spark, it just seems out of place. I don't know why. It just seemed a bit too crisp.
Well, I mean, the shot of the train and the bombing, you don't really see, which I think is a well-staged shot.
Yeah,
you don't see much of it, do you? You know, that's kind of one of the good bits of it, because really the focus is on the kid's hat falling off.
But there is a tiny little bit of a spark, and I was looking for it because of the spark at the beginning I didn't like. So I thought, well, what's it going to look like? What's this explosion and fire possibly going to look like in the tunnel? And, I was hoping there'd be a nicer roll-off in the... But not so much.
So where was the spark?
There's two. One is way back at the beginning where we've got a POV shot of her going through underneath an awning or something like that, and for no apparent...
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I thought you were talking about the train.
Yeah, and then there's a spark at the beginning of the train as well. Just the initial detonation of the explosion in the tunnel.
I agree with you. The spark's when the camera is going underneath either a patio or a... the camera's sort of travelling with you and the light bulb is kind of going or whatever, the water level's risen up. Yeah, no, I thought that was a little bit, poppy. But I just can't remember noticing the one at the explosion. I think the smoke coming out, the exterior shot of the train station and stuff was all pretty, pretty normal. And,
Look, it's not the end of the world. I liked so many of the other bits and pieces in it, like the tears going down the kid's cheek. I thought that was great. I'm just trying to find the worst possible thing to pick on because everything else was great.
So did this film, Ian, deserve an Academy Award nomination?
Oh, that's a big question. I think in the context of how the visual effects help the story, why not? You know, that's the... what the award should be for, shouldn't it? It shouldn't just be for films with 1,000 visual effects shots. Just because there's not visual effects throughout the whole film, I mean, there are, but not, you know, in a big way, doesn't mean it shouldn't be nominated. This year, of course, there's 5 nominees instead of 3.
I think that's a good move.
And which is a great move. So obviously, I don't think it would have got nominated if there were only 3.
Do you think someone was missing in this top 5?
So let me just refresh your memory. The original 15, I think it was, that went into the bake-off, of which 7 came out, Unstoppable, Tron, Sorcerer's Apprentice, Shutter Island, Scott Pilgrim, Prince of Persia, Percy Jackson, Last Airbender, Iron Man 2, Inception, Hereafter, Harry Potter, or HP7, Clash of the Titans, Narnia, Alice. So from that, we got 7 out, of which... the 7 went down to the 5. So, but let's stay with the 15 because I don't get too nasty. But just say, like, was there one of those that you surprised didn't get to the final 5?
I kind of thought Tron would. I'm quite happy that didn't, but I kind of expected it to.
I expected Tron to get a nomination. I actually would have thought that Hereafter would get nominated because... my view is that it's an example of the seamless visual effects. You know, yeah. Just whatever your opinion is about whether it works or not, the tsunami sequence. Every other film that has been nominated, I think there are very obvious visual effects in it. Even Inception, which has a lot of great practical work, you know that there's a lot of visual effects. And I feel like it's Hereafter is the example of seamless visual effects, even in that 15.
Yeah, I think Tron should have got through myself. Though I've got to point out, listeners to this show have sent me many emails saying that they disagreed vehemently with my opinion on Tron and the face replacement. But let's put the face replacement to one side and accept that everybody else in the entire VFX show listening community disagrees with me. leave the face out. I still reckon Tron should have got a nomination just for the environments, the compositing, the CG, the kind of awesome digital cinematography. So that alone meant that, and I'm not on Disney's payroll, but I honestly do. I really think it was spectacular. And quite frankly, I can't, you know, it's hard because, I mean, do I want Hereafter to not be nominated? Well, obviously not. I don't want anyone to be missing out. But I do think that I was surprised that Tron didn't get through.
Well, if you're looking at seamless VFX as a reason why a film should get into the Bake Off, should Social Network be in there? Because I thought the face replacement on that was better than Tron and all the other little bits and pieces that were floating around it. Overall, I found Social Network to be better than Tron.
I'm not going to disagree with you, but
they're smaller effects, but then again, they're not going into
it. There's no way that the visual effects, with the greatest respect, there's no way in God's good earth that the visual effects in Social Network, great.
There is the smoke breathing thing.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. I did forget about that. I'm sorry. I must have slipped and banged my head on the way in today.
So, okay. So, let's have a look at the other films. So, we've got Inception, Harry Potter, Seven, Alice, and Iron Man 2 up for this weekend's Oscar. And I'm dead serious when I say this. Obviously, being Oscar nominated is a, you know, credit in of itself, right? Like, it's completely valid and you should feel good if you'd feel bloody good if you got nominated for an Oscar. So, it's not about necessarily who wins, but just in terms of what we think about it, I guess I'm going to have to get specific and start to ask you, of those five, if you've only got to pick from those five, and let's assume now that the Academy in its wisdom has got the best five, Ian, who are you voting for this year's Oscar?
I'm voting for Inception. And the reason is that it's not just CG work or visual effects work. It's a mix of practical. If you don't know anything about how those shots were done, you will just wouldn't know. You wouldn't know that some of the elevator stuff is practical or, you know, or otherwise. And for me, that's what the visual effects Oscar should be. You shouldn't really know how it was done. And I think Inception is the best example of that amongst those five.
Matt?
Well, Iron Man 2, we've already been to Iron Man 1 country, and Iron Man 1 was awesome, so I definitely not Iron Man. But I haven't seen Harry Potter, and everyone's been raving about how great Harry Potter
is. So you didn't
Potter
see any differences between Iron Man 1 and Iron Man 2?
I did, but I don't think it was such a giant leap and bound from the first one.
And in isolation, did you think the visual effects in Iron Man 2 was good?
I thought they were great. But
you think maybe the Academy will penalise it for being a sequel?
Yeah, or maybe not. Yeah, for being a sequel and not doing so many more advancements in the field. I think...
Though it did. Enormous advancements in the field. Well, but yes, okay. It may not have appeared so on screen.
Okay. I'm sorry to everyone who worked on Iron Man 2. I didn't mean to dish you. As I said, I haven't seen Harry Potter, so I can't really comment on that one. Alice in Wonderland was just freaking insane amount of effects and amazing approaches. But overall, I think Inception just felt better and had some really cool techniques in it as well.
I don't think Hereafter is going to win because I just don't think that... It's very good fluid sims, but by that reckoning, 2012 should have won. Because 2012 had really good fluid sims, well integrated and highly detailed and highly polished. I do think that the best visual effects of last year may not be rewarded by an Oscar because the Oscar race is not a race purely on credit. There's a lot of other stuff of politics that comes into it. And quite frankly, as we know ourselves, it's really, really hard to critique and praise the effects of a film when the effects are terrific and the film isn't so good. Yeah, not saying any of these films aren't good, but you know what I mean? Like, it really colours you because I think Inception's a masterpiece. So I'm very willing to admit that I'm probably coloured in my opinion of the visual effects in part because I just think the film is so exceptionally good. Let me talk to you, Ian, about Harry Potter 7 because you have seen it. We don't get a lot of discussion about the Potter sequence, but am I right in thinking, because I think I am, that not a single Harry Potter film has won the VFX Oscar?
It hasn't, no.
Is that not an atrocity?
It feels like it, doesn't it? You know, we're up to number... Seven we're up to, and there has been some amazing work in the Harry Potter films, including in this one, you know, and very diverse work too. Creature animation, beautiful environments, so I'm a bit disappointed that it hasn't.
Some of which was well recognised by the VES at this year's VES Awards.
Yeah, that's true.
I think Dobby and Creature were some of the best skin digital rendering character stuff we've seen for ages. And I thought the motion control stuff on the multiple Harrys at the beginning, the incredible particle animation stuff on the Death Eaters was just extraordinary. I mean, there's just so much in the Potter films. I find it pretty astonishing. It's almost like if you decide not to give it to HP7, you should give it to HP8 just in advance. Just like, I don't care. You deserve it. I don't care what you do.
I don't know the reasons for it, and of course, why would we? But I wonder whether maybe part of it is because there's so much going on and they do go by very quickly. For example, the Harry, multiple Harry shots, you know, that's literally a 20-second shot, 30-second shot or something like that. And, you know, then it sort of moves on to the next sequence and it feels like you might not get much time to absorb the work.
But go back to the dragon sequence when Harry in... God, my kids are going to kill me if I get this wrong. When Harry is competing in the Triwizard Cup.
Is it Goblet of Fire?
And he has to, you know, fight the dragon and they have a flying sequence. He goes off around Hogwarts and smashes into the roof of Hogwarts and stuff. I mean, there's stuff in that that's just exceptionally good. Mm. And that's just one of many sequences. The Fluid Sims, when they do the... they go into the memory sequences from the past and they dip their head in the font and suddenly it's like it's developed into this kind of black ink kind of animation. I don't know, I just feel like I really don't know why it is. Maybe it's simply that it's so iteratively been getting better, because I do think, like, if you look at like a sequence from Harry Potter, and that's obviously flying sequences in almost every one, right? They're getting progressively better. I think it's one of those things that you just kind of don't notice how good they've got because they're building, maybe. But the Quidditch from the last one versus the first one, where the background sort of felt like cutouts a bit, I just think it was exceptional. But then again, Alice, I mean...
Do you think that maybe that's why this year we've got five contenders rather than three? Because
I think they've got five because the network that's running the Oscars want to increase the ratings, and if you have multiple films that are popular, and let's face it, nearly always the VFX category has popular films as opposed to actor or best picture, which is quite often like much smaller. I mean, I absolutely love to death Black Swan and King's Speech and stuff, but these aren't big blockbuster films. They're not multiplex films like these ones.
Yeah.
So anything that you can do to get films that the general populace know about in the Oscars means that you'll get a wider ratings pull for the nightly telecast. And I honestly think that's the only motivation whatsoever. They just want to keep the ratings up on the network.
But saying that, I still can't see everyone at home going, oh, I wonder who's going to win the best VFX Oscar this year. It doesn't seem like the most exciting one for the punters at home.
I think this is only the second
Harry Potter one to get nominated, though, out of the seven.
I think that not acknowledging the work that primarily the London houses, that wasn't always the London houses. I mean, Sony, I think, was on one or two, and ILM, of course. So, but I still, for the collective facilities that have worked on them, I think Harry Potter deserves almost a special Oscar for... and let's face it, at the box office, not that that's got anything to do with Oscar contention, it's now the most successful franchise ever, outrating, I think, the Bond films, which is saying something.
The other thing is, Mike, that it kind of fits into that category of Alice in sort of extending what I was saying before. There's so much in it. And, you know, that sort of does lead us to Alice, which I just felt had so many different techniques. And, you know, in that way, it could be recognised with the Academy Award because it's not just one thing. You know, the way they did digital creatures and extensions and, you know, augmenting Johnny Depp's eyes and just lots of little things. You know, that could be what excites people this year about... the visual effects Oscar.
Yeah, Alice had just such an awesome array of techniques, and every shot seemed to be approached differently, and the really cool tool sets that they built for easily adjusting scale and eyes and things like that. Really clever stuff.
Do we think it's interesting at all that Alice is the only 3D one in the nominated list? Or is there not much to take away from that?
Well, Avatar won a lot of stuff, and it was 3D, and I mean, so yeah, I personally don't read a ton of that stuff into that.
Then again, myself. Alice was dimensionalized for the live action bits and bobs.
Well, for the
a little bit at the beginning,
for all of it was dimensionalized. They didn't shoot stereo on the green screen of
No, so you're right.
It was dimensionalized, but it was dimensionalized as not a post-process. It was dimensionalized in that we'll shoot like a 4K camera of the Queen so that we can scale ahead and not have problems with the quality. And then we'll dimensionalize it as part of the comp, which in a sense is different to a Clash where they sort of finished the film and then handed it to somebody else to dimensionalize it. But it was a very sound decision by Ken Rolston to go that way. So it was, you know, I can see where you're coming from, because in a sense it wasn't dimensionalized like some of the other films were, but it was monocamera on the effects. I should point out, as I would say earlier, what the films are, the VFX shows that have covered these. So the first one of these is actually Alice in Wonderland we're talking about, and that was VFX show 97, if you're keeping score. 101 was Iron Man 2, 106 was Inception, and 112 was Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 1. So I'm, as I say, long-winded answer, I'm going to come back on Inception. And I'm also going to come back on Inception for one other reason. So I think that the Academy has a significant voting block of people that respect stuff done in camera. And so there's so much stuff that's done in camera on this that, unfortunately, and I'm by no means a supporter of this point of view, there's a sense of you just do it in the computer, whereas actually building an entire set on its end and having people hanging on wires seems to be, you know, cleverer, harder. The fact that that shot wouldn't have worked had they not had incredible digital rig removal is by the by. So for the reasons of supporting the story, for reasons of being getting votes from both the digital crowd and the practical crowd, and for just sheer the film is a masterpiece, I'm going to give my vote to Inception, though I would happily see all five of these films again and then twice on Sunday, because I think they're all really, really good. And each of them just does have magnificent aspects to them. I mean, there's just no doubt about it, like in my mind. I guess if you were looking forward from here, Ian, I mean, do you see films on the horizon that you would be willing to stick your neck out in the coming year? Because you're obviously keeping an eye on these things for the work you do. Do you think there are films that are coming up that you are hoping will be films we'll be discussing a year from now?
Well, I hope it's Deathly Hallows... Oh, sorry, Harry Potter 8, Part 8. You know, I hope that's the one that's sort of pushing it. It's the last film. I just hope that they really push it. And I think they want to, because they're not going to get another opportunity.
Yeah, well, we're going to have a few films by then. We'll have Cowboys and Aliens. Mm. We'll have a Spider-Man, I think. We'll have a Spider-Man by then. We'll certainly have an X-Men by then.
X-Men First Class.
A Transformers by
Transformers, Pirates.
We'll have a Thor in there as well.
Thor. Yep. So
Tintin later in the year.
Yeah, we're not going to be short of...
Is Tintin fully animated like Cars 2? Or is it live action?
Performance capture type film, as far as I understand.
But feeding digital characters, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Not sure about that. Not sure about Tintin. I could be good. Don't know. And what I really hope is that we'll get a couple of films that completely aren't on our radar, that they'll be the Inception of this year. Because, you know, a lot of those films we listed, like Transformers, like X-Men, like Spider-Man, like Pirates, though obviously not Cowboys and Aliens, are either sequels or reboots or, let's face it, material that we've walked down quite a long... I mean, Spider-Man is not exactly an original script concept at this point in time, no matter how good it is. There's a name for that now, isn't it? The actual Spider-Man film. It's gone from Spider-Man to Spider-Man... The Amazing Spider-Man,
I think,
is now the title of it.
Yeah.
I'm sure I'll go and see it. I'm sure it'll be a good film. I'm sure it'll be interesting. But it's just... it'd be good, in addition to those films, to have a come-out-of-left-field film, as I say, like an Alice did, like Inception did, that just wasn't something that was part of an existing franchise and that really took us to a place that was really unusual. And for that matter, like Hereafter, the film we've been discussing this week. Matt, anything coming up on the horizon that you really are busting to see?
Not so much. I'm really hoping to be surprised, like you said. It's those little nuggets of joy, which, you know, again, as long as I'm going to see a film for a good story and some effects happen to get it along the way, I'm happy. I'm less interested to go run off and see Pirates after the last couple, which looked very pretty but had no substance. So I think when we're here this time next year and having a chat about Oscar contenders, as long as the winners are...
I don't know if I'm going to let you to sit here this time next year unless you've seen Harry Potter Part 2, which means you have to see Harry Potter Part 1.
It's true. Otherwise, I'll never know what's going on.
You'll never know what's going on because on this particular point, my good friend Matt and I disagree most vehemently on the Harry Potter franchise, but anyway...
We haven't even discussed how we disagree on Inception, but that's a whole other podcast.
You don't like Inception?
Not so much.
Get out of town.
It looked amazing. It was great, but I just feel like it should be called exposition because it's just chunks of exposition of annoyance.
Do you like the Godfather films?
Yes, they're cool.
Okay, good.
I didn't like The Dark Knight, though, as I duck from your swinging arm.
Wound me. Oh, God. Okay. Well, we'll be returning next week with another film in the sequence. In fact, we've actually got a pretty good rundown of films coming up here. On the VFX show. We want to thank Todd Skilton, our producer, and Matt, who is sitting with me. Matt, thank you. I get to thank you in person this week for your work in editing and putting these shows together.
Always a pleasure.
And one of these days we might convince Todd to come on and then we can thank him in person. But yes, the next actual episode we're doing is, I believe, Forrest Gump, because we like to do retro ones, as we like to call them, and we look back over time and pick a film that we really, really like. And, of course, Forrest Gump's a particularly interesting film, so that's coming up, as is a bunch of other great films. And I think we have some animated ILM action, Ian, coming up on the VFX show.
That's right, Rango, which I'm very excited to see. Looks like it's been getting some really good early, early preview reviews. So, yeah, I can't wait for that.
Well, thank you so much for listening to us. As always, stay away from the light. I'll see you online. Thanks so much. Bye.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com. Copyright 2011 FX Guide, LLC.